go through it. So the first part of the talk is going to just kind of, what's the problem? Second part is a little bit of the literature. I think we've heard that quite a bit. And then a little bit on what Ted Campbell did, looking at what's going on in surface water, was looking at wells, single-family home wells associated with systems. So, again, just a quick outline. We'll talk a little bit about the cycles, waterborne outbreaks, and then a little bit on selected studies. Let's see if this goes in the right. There we go. So we know there are cycles that go on in the septic system. You produce the waste. The nitrogen gets mineralized in the tank, immobilized in the drain field. Nitrification absorption occurs at varying amounts below the drain field. And then does denitrification occur once you hit groundwater? That's always a big question. But the other cycle is the water cycle. And particularly when dealing with single-family homes that are on wells, we drink our wastewater, so to speak. All right, so that's another part of what can be of concern for us. So there are waterborne outbreaks. We can see, just looking at privately owned wells, and this is for a couple different periods, they're there. There is a risk, and there's no doubt about it. So we can't dismiss it, and I think that's what all of the speakers this morning have said. The risk exists. As far as what's causing the outbreaks, there's varying sources. Talking about what pathogens can get through the system, there's a lot that can get through, potentially. But when you're dealing also with single-family homes connected with wells, do we know if the folks in that home are sick because the young child comes home and brings something home from school, or is it directly related to their wastewater system? And is it reported? So probably some of these numbers are low because we don't know how much is actually occurring that doesn't get reported. And again, these are simply just reporting periods that were found in the literature. So a little bit on nutrients. We've seen this, I think, already as far as where some of the numbers come from, as far as total nitrogen concentrations. And they're variable. And they probably will still be variable because people have different habits. What you eat is what you excrete. So we really have a hard time in modeling some of this stuff and understanding there's a fair range, in this case, 9 to 240 in terms of the total nitrogen concentration. That's a huge range, and for modeling, it makes it difficult. So I applaud David for trying to quantify some of this. As far as removal, that also is pretty variable. And it also depends on where you look. If all you look at is what gets removed in the septic tank versus what gets removed in the leach field or what gets removed away from the drain field, what goes into the streams, as our second speaker talked about, how much actually moves into the environment. So in the case of the studies in Georgia, you're showing at, 90 centimeters below, 150, still have some nitrogen that could be moving to groundwater. But you also have another several meters to go through. And then that plume, once it hits groundwater, it has to move before it gets back to surface water. And in the process, does it go through a riparian buffer? Well, we know, at least in our state, for agricultural systems, if you put a riparian buffer on the edge of an agricultural field, you can get a 50% reduction in nitrogen and never have to monitor it. That's the BMP. But when modeling, is that included in our models when dealing with septic systems? Okay, do we consider the landscape? So there's a lot of variability out there. And that's actually part of this first study that I'm reporting on was put together by Nancy Deal, looking at the literature and just showing that there is variability. We're in the process in North Carolina of developing the TMDLs. In one of the river basins where they were developed, the folks developing the model asked for input. The on-site water protection section, the regulatory entity, was not at the table. They were not asked. When they complained, the comment was, well, you come up with your own recommendation. They did, and it was ignored. So that's a potential issue that we have without getting too political. So we know also from looking at various studies, and these are some older studies, but just showing, you know, what variability we have. 37 to 100% removal of nitrogen. So again, in the soil, depending on, in this case, fairly deep in terms of inches below the surface. And I apologize, I know it is in inches. So just, what is it, multiply by 2.5, right? Do that quick conversion. Okay? I usually have to go the other way when I'm teaching practitioners. So there is some removal. How much? We're not sure. It's system dependent. It's site dependent. When we start looking then at soil type, and I think that was pointed out very clearly, that a lot of our studies come from sands, right? And we don't have as many in the finer textured soils. In the river basin that was being looked at in North Carolina, it's all that lovely, not Georgia red clay, North Carolina red clay. All right, and so that needs to be considered when looking at that overall modeling system. How much is removed? And again, this is all in, you know, the pounds per acre and so on. Multiply pounds and you can give an idea by 2.2 and you get the kilos. So again, in terms of the mass loading, again, variable. I think these numbers do fit in pretty close to what David found out and what Art Gold has also shown. So we know that there is a, you know, anywhere from what, about 20 to 40 kilograms per year per person. But then the density comes in. In a typical three-bedroom home, how many people live there? Right? How many people? It's a range, but on average, it's 3.2 people, right, per household, right? And how many do you have per acre or per hectare, right? You know, in our area, we want the McMansions, so in much of the area. So we're looking at 1 to 2 acre lots with a 5 to 6,000 square foot house in some cases with three people living in them, if that. So again, the density plays a role as well when we start looking at the modeling. Now, there's also the question on advanced treatment, and it does play a big role. But here, and I think some of the evidence that we have, advanced treatment is great. It can remove nitrogen. It can remove phosphorus. It can remove pathogens. And I can't remember which one of the speakers mentioned it. Management and maintenance. I think you mentioned that. If they're not maintained, they don't work. An example, this anecdotal, I work with another PhD in another state who has one of these systems. He didn't know he had one. It's a gravity flow aerobic treatment unit. It should be doing a wonderful job at removing pathogens, treating, but he didn't realize you had to have power to it. So what he had was an expensive septic system that was a straight pipe. He had an overland flow system. It discharged into a swamp. So again, maintenance management is critical. So let's move to the case study. This is in Haywood County, North Carolina. It is in the mountains. Ted Campbell with North Carolina Division of Water Quality put this together. Both Nancy Deal and I were involved a little later on it. What he was looking at primarily was wells and septic systems. Haywood County, beautiful location, a little bit west of Asheville, lovely mountains. We were looking mainly at the Hyatt and Richland Creek watershed areas. Now, just quickly looking at this, you'll note that there are contaminations, but we also want to point out there are a few agricultural areas in there as well, and that may relate to some of the fecal coliform that's found in the water. So it can't be blamed on septic. But, you know, when you have wells that and systems that have kind of overflowed a little bit right next to a creek,
maybe the septic system's responsible? You think probably? Probably. Okay. But animals love water. If there's a nice stream there, they're going to be in it. And in this case, this stream is partially contained, and it discharges. Okay, what do cows do when they're outside? They don't have a lot of sphincter control. So we end up having things in the wastewater. But of course, we also have the straight pipes. This is not a slaughterhouse. Okay, part of North Carolina's programs is WADE, the wastewater elimination service. So it's trying to remove these. They have to identify them first. So using dye, we can tell, and you can see we actually have two colors here. This is the toilet, and this is the sink. Okay? So you have two different point sources here. So these are obviously major problems. Problems also occur where we have a failing system that as it bubbles up and rainfall occurs, it rolls into the creek. We know these exist. But the question is, what about those ones that are far away and also on wells? Are the wells contaminated? So started with surveys, looked at the soils, looked at the wells, looked at spring houses, because a lot of the folks up in this area still use springs, and then looked at some of the ones that were suspect and sent some samples to a USGS lab to look for emerging contaminants and stable isotopes. I'm not going to comment on the stable isotopes, mainly because they didn't show anything. They're very difficult to figure out exactly what we were looking at. And that's something that the literature, there's a lot of variability. So they also were looking at pH and a whole suite of contaminants, nutrients, bacteria, ions, and again, resampled wells, just the ones that were suspect. So the focus area in terms of the resampling was just at the kind of the little further down on Hyatt Creek. That's where we went out and did our borings and looked at the soil. What we found, for fecal bacteria, one detect. Right, that's it. And related to a contamination at the wellhead where casing was cracked. And there were a few critters around it. So it's pretty obvious. Fixed it, no problem. There were total coliform, and again, these were where we had some of the higher nitrate values. So these are suspect, but they didn't have the high fecal. So something's going on there. In terms of emerging contaminants, boron, etc., below detection limit, did not find anything. Now, that could be that it's not in the wastewater to begin with. It could be that it's being treated very well. We don't know. But we know it. We just know that they're not there. Nutrients, a lot of them were below or near detection limits. Optical brighteners as well. Now, I have sometimes an issue with optical brighteners since we don't really know how it's treated. Is it a good tracer? If we're looking for treatment and not just where the water moves. Salts, again, no conclusive signature. So just, again, summarizing it, 73% were above the detection limit. There's some nitrate there, but only a couple of them were above 6, and only one was above 10, which is the safe drinking water. Now, this could be simply because of dilution. It could be because of the depth of the well. There's a lot of reasons for it. But what it's showing is that the signature of wastewater, treated or otherwise, in the well, the drinking water wells, is not great. It's pretty small. So, again, the conclusions, only one well had and the 2L is our groundwater rules for wells. Only one had problems. Maximum nitrate was 6.2, right? And it's very low in the majority of them. Emerging contaminants were not observed. I'd love to actually go back and see what the folks were using, because if they're not using them, I don't think we'll find them. But in general, the conclusion that was made was that septic contamination in the wells, and I want to stress it, it's in the wells, not the surface water, was minor in this setting. And it was actually expected to be enormous. That's what all of the residents thought. So again, going back to the cycles, a lot of our concern has been what's going on in surface water, and that is a major concern. I'm not trying to dismiss it. But we also need to be concerned, or at least consider, if I can get it, what's going on down in here? What's going on as that water moves away from the lot into the well and into a surface water that is distant from it, as opposed to something that is right next to the creeks, right next to those water bodies. So in general, there is a risk. Again, it's there with newer systems, finding the failing systems, make sure that they're working properly, and what we've found over and over again, maintenance is critical. When there's a problem, fix it. As far as nitrogen, based on the literature, there's a lot of variability. One size does not fit all. You can't use the data from a sandy soil and apply it to a clay soil. You just can't do it. You also need to look at the geographic setting. If there are significant riparian buffers, do they have an effect? I would hope that they do based on the literature, based on the research that's done. Failing and illegal discharge systems are still going to be problematic. So when a system fails, when it's a straight pipe, you know, that's a bad thing. That shouldn't be happening. But it's not something that we should use to say that all septic systems are bad. Properly maintained systems seem to work pretty well. Right. So with that,
thanks,
Dave. Mike? I guess, question?
One's probably ran.
They're probably
any
done.
Questions?
Go ahead. Yes. We actually, failing septic systems in North Carolina are defined, and they're defined pretty, I don't know if you can say narrow, wide. Effluent to the surface is one criteria. Effluent or spongy soil, for lack of a better term, within 3 inches of the surface. So in other words, if the trench is backing up, the water, the effluent's not at the surface, but if it's within 3 inches, that's considered failing. As I said, direct discharge is failing, either to the surface or surface water. If we go in and we auger down and we find that there is effluent in direct discharge to groundwater, in other words, the water table comes up into the system, that's considered failing. Using soil morphology, we can tell whether that's likely or not. So we look at all of those criteria as to what is a failing system. We've gone beyond that in some cases and started to look at water use as well. If water use is above 70% of design, that's not necessarily a failing system, but that is a system with a red flag. The water use should be below 70% of the design capacity. So it is fairly defined.
Right? I just have go ahead, Paul.
Just going back to traces for a minute, in my talk I mentioned that in the past we've used boron as our tracer. That's becoming less reliable because boron levels in detergents are going down and detergents are changing. We're now looking for an alternative tracer to see how important our septic tank systems are. I'm a little bit disheartened by your experience.
Well, I mean, this is my opinion, so shoot the messenger. If you use a conservative tracer like boron, it's not treated. And one of the things that we have to remember with a septic system, we are looking for treatment. So if you have a constituent that simply moves with the water, Well, I can guarantee you that virtually every septic system, the effluent that comes through it, will make it back to surface water sometime. That drop of water. And if the boron's going on with it and it's not treated, all you can tell is that the water made it back to surface. So I think it is not a single, single bullet. It is a bunch of them, combining ammonia, nitrate. Well, if nitrate's getting in, and you can say that it's coming from the septic system, one argument is you're probably having treatment because it's aerobic, and you're killing off the bacteria, or I hope you're getting most of them, okay? But the nitrate then becomes problematic, right? So that's kind of the dilemma that we sit in. In North Carolina, our trenches are called nitrification trenches. They are designed to put nitrate back into the environment. Okay, but if we find ammonia, that means the treatment is not happening.
Yeah, but there's other sources of ammonia.
You're right. That is. But again, if we're looking at treatment, and I want to stress that, a conservative tracer like boron doesn't tell you about treatment. It just tells you that the water is getting there. Now, it could be the same thing, though, right?
I mean, people are doing that. So my question is going to be, I don't know if you know the method that they use, but a lot of people on older studies have been using, they don't use isotope dilution. So you may not find something because there's too much matrix suppression.
You're absolutely right. But again, if it moves with the water and it's not treated, do we know that treatment has occurred?
No, but by the time you wait and measure something like ammonia,
that's what I'm getting at is that there is no perfect solution. Using a suite of things, bacterial source tracking, using the sweeteners, even still using the borons, the optical brighteners, all of that, combining them together, you can say, yes, we have a contaminant, we have water coming from the septic system, okay, and do we have treatment? So you're combining two factors. It's not one thing, it's a bunch.
Yeah, I appreciate the problem.
And that's the struggle that we've had, I think, in looking at some of this. So again, I appreciate the section. It was some great talks.
David, I have a question. With the valves that you were monitoring in your state, did you also have information about hydrology, that if the water from drain field is actually going in the same direction as well?
No. Okay. And again, that was not the purpose of the study. The purpose was, again, to show, do we have a direct connection between them? No, in that area, it's all fractured bedrock. I mean, we could have something coming from the other side of the mountain, potentially. Yeah, maybe not quite that extreme. But, we don't, that was not done. When we've done other studies, we generally find more in coastal plain areas. We will find a little bit more nitrate, but not as much as we'd expected. So.
Thanks.
All right, thank you.